Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write also happens to be what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA or their upcoming Writers Conference. It'll be the end of July. July 25th is the date, I believe. Mark it on your calendars. You can learn more about that at PNWA.org. So speaking of conferences, you go to a conference, they always want to know what genre you are, so you know who to pitch to and who to talk to and so on. But genre is a tricky thing. It's a sales device, of course, but writers are often encouraged to know what their genre is and to research their genre because they want to know where they belong. But I think today's guest, Benjamin Percy, didn't ever get that notice. Perhaps because his second novel and his most recent novel, Red Moon, certainly is literary in its approach. You could put it in the literary section if you wanted to, but it is paced like a suspense novel, no doubt about that. But oh, by the way, it also has lycanthropes in it. So where does it belong exactly? I don't know. But it doesn't really matter. But I do know that I want to get to know Benjamin and hear what he has to say on the matter. So let's do that. Benjamin, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It is my pleasure. So, all right, Ben. So you just got back from not that long ago. You're in Wisconsin now, but is it Minnesota or Wisconsin? Excuse me.
Minnesota.
So you're back.
In flyover country, they all merge together.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, so there you are in Minnesota, and you've finished up your tour for Red Moon recently.
I started off in London and ended in Berkeley, so I was
wow.
collecting frequent flyer miles and single-serving shampoos.
Well, at least there's some bennies to all this, but I would imagine, I always wonder about when you go on a book tour, there's the book as it exists in your imagination, having written it, and then as you go out, you begin to meet all the people who hopefully some of whom have read it or about to read it, and you begin to learn what the book became in their imagination. Are you ever interested in the difference between what you wrote and what was read? If that makes sense.
Well, sure. I'm oftentimes curious too who my reader might be, and it was a pleasure to see such a varied audience as I was city hopping over the past few months. So I saw 70-year-old women in the audience, and so did I see 16-year-old boys. I saw the casual reader, and I saw academics interested in assigning to their classes. So it's not only a pleasure to realize that I have such a diverse audience, but also to realize that there are all these different interpretations of what the book is, what it's accomplishing, how it's touching people.
Did the readers get a chance to share some of those interpretations with you?
When I set out to write this book, I was thinking about moving people on different planes. If you consider the parallel of writing to music, Aaron Copland has a theory that there are three planes of listening. And on the first plane, your experience is sort of sensory level. You're listening to music and being affected by Nora Jones trembling from the coffee house speakers and you feel soothed, or you're listening to Metallica raging from your car stereo and you feel, maybe a little bit trembly and anxious. And in that same way, most people read. Most people go to a book just to be swept away, to feel terror or to feel a heart flutter or whatever else. And so I was trying to appeal to that audience. I was trying to appeal to that level, but at the same time trying to appeal to that third plane as well, which Aaron Copland refers to as the compositional plane, where a person can be listening to music and figuring out what instruments are swelling together and even know how it looks as sheet music. And so I'm trying to, you know, you referred to the book before as being both literary and genre, and that's what I was hoping to accomplish, is to sort of make this both a beach read, pure escapism, popcorn entertainment, but at the same time be, should you want to access it on this level, and thought-provoking and full of careful carpentry.
Right. You know, there's the old saw, which is you should write what you want to read. Does that, what you've just described for me, is that a book you would love to read?
I guess you could say that, because I'm frustrated by people's constant attempt to tag, to label.
Right.
If I look at some of the books that I admire most, if I look at Cormac McCarthy, or if I look at Margaret Atwood, or if I look at Kate Atkinson, or Dennis Lehane, or Dan Simmons, what part of the bookstore do they belong in? I mean, it could just as easily be literature as it could be Western or sci-fi or fantasy or mystery. And really, when it comes down to it, these are all phantom barricades. It doesn't matter. It's all taxonomy. And I'm looking for something that is gripping. I mean, the reason that I began reading, that I wanted to be a writer initially, was to figure out what happens next. And I never want to forget about that question. But I also want to put it really in a really base way. You know, I'm looking for pretty sentences. I'm looking for three-dimensional characters. I'm looking for glowing metaphor.
I love pretty sentences too, but why? And that's a tricky question, but why is that valuable? Who cares? Pretty, are they effective? Why is pretty valuable to you?
Well, I guess you could...
Readers who don't believe in such a thing.
David, it has to do with artistry. It has to do with that careful carpentry I was referring to before. And certainly, you know, you don't have to be show-offy about it. I think that the danger is if the pretty sentences get in the way of comprehension, if the author seems as though they're performing a triple backflip at every sentence, and that's obnoxious. You know, the key is using the sentences to replicate the content. And, you know, I'm very fastidious and methodical about all of this, in the way that I try to match style and content. And, you know, I can give you just a really offhand example of this. If I have a scene where a character is running, I'm going to try to have a breathless pace, and I'm going to have a series of sentences that go on and on and on and on, so that by the time you get to that period, you feel as though your lungs have flattened.
Right.
So that's just an example of of style servicing the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the triple backflip metaphor is apt, and why I think it shouldn't apply to writers, because if you look at the gymnast, if the gymnast is, or the figure skater, if they're performing a triple axel, there is one way a triple axel is essentially supposed to be performed, and the judges rate them according to whether they've done it. But that isn't so for the artist. There isn't that you are creating your own double backflip every time you reach the page. So there is no preordained idea of what that sentence should be. It has to be original to that moment. Yeah.
True. Well, and also, the issue becomes people learn how to do the triple backflip, or they learn how to do the triple axel, and then they use it irregardless of what the situation dictates. You know, it could be somebody drinking coffee, and you have sentences that are almost that look like something drawn from Nabokov, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you need to shine a spotlight on sentences when you're trying to sort of say that this is important, this means something, or this is contributing to the sense of suspense, or this is contributing to a sense of fragmentation, or whatever else.
Yeah,
I'm an author masturbating on the page.
Exactly. I fell into that when I did develop enough skill that I could sort of pull off what needed to be pulled off. I would sometimes find myself imitating what I thought of as good writing when I didn't actually know what it was I wanted to say. So it kind of looked right, but there was nothing beneath that other than just the form of what would be, quote, good or skilled writing. But I wasn't
right.
I had become disconnected from what it was I was sharing, and it amounted to very little.
Yeah, I see that all the time when I'm teaching at conferences and teaching workshops to students, and that they once they acquire that arsenal, that craft arsenal, they forget about story, and it becomes all about how they can stack clauses upon each other.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that you came to writing because I assume you were. I can picture in my head like a 9 or 10 year old boy wanting to know what happens next in the story, and that's absolutely where I came from. Was that when you first woke up to the sort of power of story, or did it go back even further to when you were reading and falling in love with the written word?
Well, I come from a family of voracious readers. We would spend almost every evening sprawled out in the living room, each with a different mass market paperback in hand, sometimes reading passages aloud. I did not know that I would become a writer. I did not fancy the idea of becoming a writer for some time, though. I had other dreams initially, and those fantasies sort of dissolved. You know, those fantasies were everything from archaeologist to international man of mystery. And it wasn't until I was in college that I took my first creative writing workshop. I mean, I grew up out in the sticks of Oregon. I grew up in a very rural area, and I never met an author until I was in college. It just didn't seem really like a feasible career. So it was only then, when I found myself in this creative writing workshop, that I fell in love with storytelling, realized that I had some skills, and began waking up at 4:30 every morning in order to get get some pages out of my system.
You know, you mentioned that you grew up in the sticks, as you said, and that story, in one form or another, is quite common with writers. Most people who are now professional writers did not grow up surrounded by other professional writers. It's a somewhat, as a profession, it's rather removed from everybody else. You might meet a lawyer, but you're less likely to meet and know a professional author. And so was there a sort of psychological hump you had to get over in order to allow yourself to be that, or did it happen so organically that you never had sort of crossed that Rubicon, you know?
Well, to this day, I feel as though the fraud police, as Charles Baxter refers to them, are going to seek me out. You know, every time I'm before an auditorium full of people, I feel like somebody's in the back row, they're going to stand up and say, you know, what are you doing up there? Make room for somebody more deserved. And part of that just comes from the fact that I grew up in pretty humble circumstances. And, you know, this seemed like a very spoiled sort of situation to be in that I make crap up, and that's my industry. So there's always that sort of anxiety trembling around the edges of my mind, and I'm constantly coming up with backup careers in case this whole writing thing doesn't work out.
Oh, it looks like it's working out pretty well for you. You know, I read an article or a short essay you wrote in, I think it was Glimmer Train, and you talked about a very interesting story about, I think it was about writing Refresh, if I got the details correct here, that was where you allowed yourself to pour everything you had into a story.
Oh, yeah. That was my all-in essay.
Yeah.
And I had been rationing up to that point. I had notebooks stacked up, you know, those little moleskin notebooks.
Yeah.
I had those stacked up next to my desk, still warm from my pocket, fresh with ink. I had a cork board hanging beside my desk as well that was confettied with different 3x5 note cards and articles ripped from magazines. And one of the things I was doing was rationing things out, thinking like, okay, I'll use these few things for this story, and then I'll hold out for the next one. And what you come to discover, of course, is if you're a serious writer, if you're spending a good amount of time at the desk, is that there's always more timber coming down the trail.
Yeah.
And you should never hold back. You know, you should let it go now. Whenever you feel that electrical current, you should just let it pour out of you. And that was the first story where I just said, it's all in. You know, I gambled everything that I had at that moment. Every cool metaphor, every gymnastic sentence, every emotion, I tossed it all into the pot. And it paid off. And that was not only a breakthrough story for me professionally, but aesthetically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And so you were holding back because you had a fear that maybe there was a limit to what your imagination would provide for you, that you had to kind of string it along for your whole life.
Exactly. I mean, I think it just came from my practice at that time of writing fairly short pieces, stories that were 10 pages long, 12 pages long. When I first wrote Refresh, it was 45 pages. And that story ended up stripped down considerably for the Paris Review to 18 pages. But I had to cram it all in there to make it come alive.
Yeah. And look at this. We've got someone who wants to ask you a question. Ben, you want to take a question from one of our listeners?
Sure, give me.
I think I know who this is. Jeffrey, is this you?
It is, Bill. Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to congratulate you on the recent release of your Write Within Yourself, an Author's Companion, that wonderful compilation of essays that you've
read and
shared with the world. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Benjamin, Bill often allows me to call in and ask this question to fellow writers. And I love what you said about someone standing up in the back of the auditorium. I'm always afraid it's going to be a scene from the famous movie, The Invasion of Body Snatchers, when the person goes, points the
fire. Right. Siren wail comes out of their mouth.
So, Benjamin, I wanted to ask you what your process is, your writing process. Do you outline, take notes? What's your daily writing routine like? And thank you both for taking my question.
Oh, my pleasure. We'll put you on hold so you can listen. How do you do it? Ben, are you an outliner?
Yeah, I typically, with novels especially. I mean, short stories are more impressionistic. Sometimes I only know a few things about them. I'm willing to fail and to start again. So I don't always outline considerably with the short story. But with a novel, I know that there are a lot of different approaches to this, and you just have to figure out what works best for you. What works best for me is, you know, I can't conceive of building a cathedral without a set of blueprints before me. That's not the way my mind works. And so I begin thinking about a novel almost a year in advance of composing it, and I rip off of my kids, Melissa and Doug Arditel, a 10-foot scroll of paper, and I hang it from my office wall, and I start to sketch out first the characters. And by sketch out, I mean I cartoon them, but I also supply Wikipedia entries on their history. And then I start to figure out what they want, what they desire. And when I start to put obstacles in the way of that desire, I'm beginning to build plot points. And so I've got these different character threads going across this 10-foot scroll. And then I'm starting to figure out it looks like a cardiogram or a seismograph, or what I call it is a suspense-o-meter. Yeah. And so I'm sketching over the top of this these peaks and valleys, and the peaks are where the action comes to a summit, where the stakes are highest, and the valleys are moments of repose. And I'm trying to figure out, like, this larger, I guess you could call it, orchestration of suspense and fear, and then I start to move stuff around accordingly.
You know, speaking of fear, Ben, this is a scary book, and it was, like, scary from the moment I opened it, I got to tell you. Which I'm sure pleases you. I hope it pleases you. But why scare people? Why scare people? I know it sounds like a silly question, but I don't like to be scared. But I read this book, and I was scared throughout it. Why scare people? Why is that useful?
I don't know about useful,
but why
it has to. It has to do with you know, every child's favorite game is Daddy, pretend you're a monster and chase me. Right? And that's a very elemental version of this. the supernatural thriller, the horror novel, the dark fantasy, in which we're able to face our fears and darker the darker subject matter that sadly occurs, as we know from our own experience and from the headlines that occupy so many newspapers and magazines. Like, you can deal with this subject matter in a safe sort of way. I mean, writing and reading is all about empathy. It's all about getting into other people's heads, traveling to different places, coming to understand the way the world works from so many different angles. And one of the requirements of the honest writer is to take a lantern to the darker corners of human experience. So sometimes certain writers linger there a bit longer than others.
Yeah, you know, what
and
do you think about
this book?
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, if you look at this book, like, it has that, it's tied so closely to terrorism. And,
yes.
You know, if you think about the stories, the fantasy stories, the horror stories that continue to resonate, they oftentimes are channeling cultural unease. You know, if you think of Frankenstein as a good example of this, and the way it's tapped into the Industrial Revolution, the fear of science and technology, and the fear of man playing God, or, you know, You guys just mentioned Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and that's another great example. It's the Red Scare, it's McCarthyism.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about, what do we fear right now, and how can we sort of process it?
Yeah.
When I was writing that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It was right there from the get-go. And, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about horror and cultural, that Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Bram Stoker's Dracula all came to them in dreams. All three of those great, where they woke up from the story, they woke up from a horrible dream and began writing down. At least that's the story anyway. And that something was bubbling around in that Victorian era that called up these classic monsters now that have become, you know, a part of our psyche now.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that.
It is interesting to think about hallucinogenic drugs or dreams, however they came up with it. But it was, you know, I guess you could say that some of my work does come from the ether. But it seems like if they are coming out of one's dreams are oftentimes settling up with one, you know, they're sort of settling anxieties. They're figuring out things that you couldn't figure out during the day. And we live in a culture of fear right now.
Right.
I mean, I'd say that's one of the things that defines us. And fear and paranoia. So I'm tackling that in what is, I guess, this not a dream but a nightmare of a novel.
Well, and you know, it's a funny, writing to me has always felt dreamlike in a way. I always feel like when I'm, there is the sort of planning and thinking, but when the actual experience of writing has always had a quality of meditation or entering into a kind of self-induced hypnosis. I don't know if you experience it that way, but that's common for a lot of writers.
Yeah, no, it's a trance. You're dreaming with your eyes open. There's that zone you go to, and it's similar to the zone that athletes experience, where the rest of the world sort of blurs away and you're able to laser in on something. And sometimes, you know, hours will go by and you rise up gasping with 10 pages in front of you, not quite sure where they came from. And that's the it place. That's the place you want to be. And it's impossible to be if you're, you know, always checking your Facebook status or tweeting or answering emails as you're writing. So I try to, you know, to accommodate that trance, I try to unplug as much as I can.
I always feel like it's a valuable experience. I mean, you can't enter a trance in life. You've got to keep your eyes and ears open. But there is something about the receptive nature of writing, about sort of inviting in your imagination to provide you with the beginnings, at least, of what you need, that I have found useful in answering questions away from the desk in terms of what should I do next in my life at this point. I won't enter a trance, but I'll use that same sort of receptive asking that gives me the answers to my writing can provide it in life. I don't know if you've ever made that particular link or not.
No, I don't know if I've thought about that. It sounds very yogi-esque.
Maybe
I guess I can see it. You know, You go to that quiet place, and building fiction is similar to putting together puzzle pieces. So you're puzzling together some issue in your life and dealing with hypothetical scenarios and figuring out how they might conclude. Makes sense to me.
So let me ask you this. I like to ask my writers this towards the end of our conversations, if we have time. See if you can finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
Well, it's taught me many things. One of them is that persistence matters more than talent, and that I have encountered so many different talented people who have hung up their tools. I can remember somebody I went to grad school with who submitted a story to the Atlantic Monthly, and based on that one rejection, he gave up on it. I can still remember the story so vividly to this day. It was called The Names of Bamboo, and it undoubtedly would have been published, and that student undoubtedly could have gone on to become a writer, a professional writer,
right,
had he been bullheaded enough. And that's the thing that most people aren't willing to be, is to stack up the hours and to shrug off the rejection, the endless rejection, the rejection that will follow you through your entire career, and to battle on despite the fact that so many people are saying no. And even after somebody says yes, after that agent says yes, after that editor says yes, you're still going to be faced with this tide of negativity, because every time you try to do something that is, sort of risky or brave in life, people are going to try to make you feel lousy about it. So, I'm talking about everything from reviews to,
yes,
on Amazon, to reviews in newspapers, to
That's
just
right.
the way people might treat you at cocktail parties. And what matters
That's
is
right.
you have this just single-minded drive, this desire that overwhelms everything else, this obsession. Writing has to be an obsession, a religion.
Yeah.
These 26 letters have to matter to you as the most important invention in the world, and that passion will carry you through and allow you to just sort of develop a callus around your heart the size of a catcher's mitt.
Yeah. It's such a good point, and I'm glad you mentioned the rejection and the reviews. I always think of, I watched a video or movie by Scorsese, I think it was called Don't Look Back, but it was about Bob Dylan during that era when he was when he had Subterranean Homesick Blues had come out, and he had and Highway 61 Revisited, and he was performing all these plugged-in songs, and no one knows now, because that's the canon of rock and roll, of that kind of music, that he got booed every night. Every night he got to perform, he was booed, the great Bob Dylan. And he had to go out to get booed every night. Would you want to get booed every time you sat down to write, every time you went to read? But we forget
right.
that now.
Well,
we think that someone like that never receives criticism, but everybody has to deal with it. Everybody,
yeah.
you know.
And
plenty so,
of people are still booing. Plenty of people are still booing.
Yes,
Bob Dylan.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And it's easy for me to forget, because I love these people. Well, thank you. That was a great note to end on, because I really want our listeners to hear that what you're going through, if you're not yet having a full professional career, you still have to contend with it as a professional writer. It's not just for the beginner. It's for all of us. Well, Ben, thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. And, folks, thank you so much for listening. It's been another great conversation. Remember that if you think you've got a career going, or you think you will get a career going someday once you publish that book, and you think that what you're doing now, if you're still getting started, isn't real, it's just as real as what Ben is doing, what I'm doing, what anyone is doing. Every step is the first step, is the part of the whole journey. So look, take all your actions, all your decisions, all your efforts seriously. They all matter, because you matter and life matters. And that's really all there is to it. Until next week, this has been Bill Knauer with Benjamin Percy, author of Red Moon. Take care of yourself. Do what you love. Live what you love. Love what you love. I don't care. Just love something.